Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am Sal, and along with my ever-genial host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak, and hello again for the new year, and we're back to our normal one-hour format this week. And for the full hour, we're going to have a returning guest here to talk about the United States Marine Corps, power projection, and the direction that we're heading with Dakota Woods, Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Marine Corps, retired, and now taking the Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments seat. Just as a reminder for those that are with us live, if you hadn't joined the chat room with the usual suspects, please feel free to hop in there, and if you have some observations about the conversation or if you have some points you want to bring up or questions yourself, please fold them in right there. And Eagle One and myself will pick that up and try to bring it into the conversation as soon as we can. And for those new listeners to Midrats, if you want to catch up on some of our previous shows, just go over to Blog Talk Radio. You can get all the archives there, including this show when it's done. Or you can just set yourself up to get the podcast on iTunes. And now let's get on with the show. Dakota, welcome back to Midrats.
It's just a real pleasure for me to be here. You guys are just a blessing for this whole community, and I'm really privileged to be part of the show this week.
Beautiful. Thanks. And for those that remember Dakota from our first visit, we only had him on for 20 minutes, and 20 minutes wasn't enough. So we're really glad that he was able to take some time today to give us a whole hour. And what I wanted to roll your way is kind of an opening question to the conversation, Dakota, is there are in the Navy Marine Corps team, there are some conversations that, frankly, you know, cannot be ignored. And I think what we saw this fall is the Navy came out, and I'm paraphrasing a bit here, of course, but it said we have developed these amphibious ships that are so expensive and carry so many Marines and so much materiel, and they're, to use their word, exquisite, that we can't get within 25 nautical miles of shore. So Marines, y'all are going to have to cover that gap. And that conversation kind of died away, but I think it needs to come back to the front again, because if you look at SecDef Gates' proposals for some budgetary reductions and some programs that he's going to let go, most notably the Expeditionary Fighting Vehicle and some other items that, you know, give the ability to move long distances fairly quickly, that I don't think that 25 nautical mile is either realistic or is even advisable to that point. So just from the Marine Corps perspective, do you see that 25 nautical mile being re-engaged vigorously? And what are some things that we can do to try to mitigate that so everything doesn't have to be perfect, but we still have the ability to project power and logistical support ashore in a non-permissive environment?
Yeah, you know, I think Under Secretary Work, Bob Work, was trying to address basically this point when he talked with the CSIS crowd a couple months ago. And that was talking about this 25 nautical mile gap, the ship-to-shore closure range you just talked about, you know, the initial concepts of operating from over the horizon, exploiting the vast stretches of the maritime environment as maneuver space, trying to avoid a frontal engagement with the enemy, and those kinds of issues. And he was saying that, you know, it might be that looking at this operational challenge in different ways will reveal different answers than what we had come to expect would be the answer, and that was the Expeditionary Fighting Vehicle and the operational concepts it was supposed to be able to put into practice. And he said that appreciating, I think, to a greater extent, that any kind of an operation in the environment that you described is going to be much more joint, and you'll have greater access to a wider range of capabilities to try to make the problem less of a challenge than it would be otherwise. And by that, what he was getting at, and I agree with him, is that you're going to try to do everything you can to make the enemy less of a threat than would otherwise be the case by a number of fires components, whether it's cyber, to try to blind them or confuse them, long-range strike, throw in deception operations, I mean, just a number of things to mitigate the threat that the enemy poses. And what the Undersecretary went on to say was, if you can do that, it may very well be that the current fleet of ships can get much closer than what the Navy and the Marine Corps were originally expecting. So he doesn't seem to think that this 25 nautical mile range is some sacrosanct, you know, near limit that you just can't close within. The challenge is always to try to understand the balance between operational demand from the commanders, you know, where do I want forces to be in the world for various reasons, you know, presence or deterrence or actually responding to a crisis, the threat that you expect to meet, and that threat has been evolving for the last 20 or 30 years, and we can talk about that here in just a second, and then the resources that are available to try to design solutions to the challenges that you've assessed you're going to encounter. What the Secretary of Defense has said is the resources will no longer be there as much as they have been in the past several years. So your budgetary discretion is going to be more restricted, and you're going to have just less money to try to get the resources and apply those in ways along the EFE program and other programs that the Secretary noted. So if you don't have the resources available and the threat is worsening, and the operational demand is still there, it seems to me that you need to be more creative at how you approach these particular environments. And go ahead.
Yeah, if I could readdress, you know, the comments you brought up by Undersecretary Work, lack of a better phrase, you know, preparing the battlefield, so to speak. I mean, there's nothing really new there. That's always been assumed, that you do everything you can to better create a less non-permissive environment for when you're going ashore. But you fold into that the resource limitations that are realistic. What additional tools are we going to have in place that we didn't have in place in the fall when that initial 25 nautical mile discussion came forward? In order to create that, I think people like to throw out cyber there, and that's a possibility. But there's some realistic facts that we just don't have as many tools in place. Something as simple as LCS is not going to have the non-line of sight missile. They have, I believe, the Gremlin coming in its place, which has its own issues. So what other tools are we going to have to be able to do that? Or is it more along the lines of what you're talking about, that we just need to take back, take a deep breath, and say, hey, maybe we need to find other ways to do this with the tools we already have in place?
Yeah, well, you know, one tool is, I mean, I'm not trying to be cavalier, but it's expectations management. You know, what can be done in a given situation with what you have available, and along with that come, a serious discussion on casualties and what it really means to, confront and defeat, a determined opponent with substantial, offensive and defensive capabilities. And we saw kind of a national reaction, primarily at the political level, on casualty rates on the IEDs that became a real matter of Iraq. And yet the casualties that we were experiencing were historically low numbers when you compare any other period of offensive operations or combat that the country has been engaged in. So, it's been such a long time since you were down in a pretty nasty fight and taking casualties and suffering significant levels of attrition that we've kind of forgotten in some ways what that kind of warfare is all about. And you're right. I mean, the Marines had said, look, we're going to try to prepare the battle space. One way to do that is to come racing in from an extended range, catch the enemy by surprise, by, flanking them, trying to go where he's not, hopefully being supported by, various types of fires. And it just seemed that when we try to go for a leap ahead capability technologically, the Army has run into this with their future combat system and found they just couldn't make those technological gains that were critical to that program. And the Marine Corps has experienced the same kind of problems for 9 on 20 years. time and unlimited resources. We have a fantastic vehicle out there, but we no longer have the time. We certainly don't have the resources.
Dakota, if I could break in for a second, you're kind of breaking up. I don't know if you've moved to another part of the room or something, but your connection is getting a little rough. Would you, if you haven't moved, would you like me to call you back, see if we can get a better connection?
Well, how about this? Is this better?
That's much better, yes. Please, okay. Continue.
Yeah. No, I was saying that, you know, we don't have, you know, unlimited time or resources, as the Secretary had mentioned, and so we just have to make better do with what we have. So, you know, you had started to imply before about numbers mattering. I mean, it was implicit in these kind of exquisite platforms. You know, these are very capable amphibious ships, but we have a dwindling number of them. Numbers really do matter when you're in an attrition-intense fight, and when the enemy's capabilities and anti-ship cruise missiles and other tools at his disposal, you know, become more and more capable. So, you know, we're talking about a future environment where you have fewer major platforms going up against an enemy that has more capabilities in terms of offensive firepower, and really little experience with the kinds of casualty levels and attrition problems that we have had to deal with in times past. And so I think what this calls the Marine Corps to do is to really hearken back to fairly early in its history, back in the 30s, if not the 20s, and reassess what the operational and threat requirement is and what kinds of solutions are appropriate to that in terms of operational concepts and how you use capabilities that you'll have for the next decade or two, meaning the AAV, LCAC, LCU, and maybe some follow-on capabilities there. So what I would encourage is something like the Calibra series of fleet landing exercises that were embarked on in the 1930s, and have some serious discussions, some serious analysis, and some serious experimentation projects ongoing in the next few years before they try to settle in on a specific materiel solution to replace the loss of the EFE, if that actually comes about. I mean, Congress still has a say in this. So, you know, the problems they're facing are dwindling numbers that you'd already mentioned, preference for high-end, very highly capable, technologically sophisticated, but very expensive systems, which drive them to acquire fewer and fewer of them, also problematic in an attrition environment, and really a lack of amphibious exercises and training, since they have had to focus, for obvious reasons, on sustained land operations ashore in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I would encourage the Marine Corps to take the next couple of years and really go through some serious analysis and experimentation, and then come up with some proposed solutions and see what industry can provide.
Well, speaking of serious analysis, I noticed in an article that was written about the decision to cancel the EFE that General Amos said, among other things, that it was too expensive and was going to eat up the entire Marine Corps vehicle budget, essentially, that it was made after a four-month-long force structure review. And I think here's what he said. We had 60 colonels that we shoved pizzas under the door every day and wouldn't let them come out until they had products that made sense. Are you aware of that research? And did you share any of that pizza?
I didn't get to partake in the pizza party, but I mean, it was telegraphed earlier this summer, this past summer, and the Secretary of the Navy, you know, laid down a directive, as well as the Secretary of Defense, and asked the Marine Corps to go back and review, you know, what it is, what it thought it needed to do, and the resources and how to organize best, you know, for that challenge. And so they convened this force structure review group. That group has been meeting now for several months, and I believe its report is in the hands of senior leadership in the Marine Corps, and elements of that I think will be trotted out over the next month or two as well, accounting for, you know, these recent decisions on reduction in end strength and reduced funding for some key programs. So I've not seen or been, you know, briefed on the results of that report, but I think even not seeing it, it's reasonable to expect that they were planning on a reduced Marine Corps in size, going from 2,000 down to something else, 185, 180, 175, somewhere in there. Where are you going to take those reductions? You know, keep the same number of units and just staff them at the lesser strength, or actually cut off units and reduce the size of the force that way? And in terms of resourcing, what kinds of equipment sets do you need, you know, to go about and do the job that, that we've been discussing here? So that report is still under wraps from what I understand, but I've also heard that it should be released here in the February-March timeframe, and it will probably account for or be modified to account for the recent decisions by the Secretary.
Dakota, you put out a recent article called Caught on a Lee Shore. If anybody can Google that title, Caught on a Lee Shore, and you can find it. And you you coined a phrase here that caught my eye, and I wonder if you could expand on it, because I think you were speaking about it in reference to the EFV, but I think it applies in a lot of places. You use the phrase conceptual stagnation. If you could, for the listeners, kind of define for us how you term that and where you think it applies on how we're thinking.
I think it's a result of the programmatic environment, especially in Washington, D.C., where even in good years, the services need to compete for funding for major programs. And, you know, we're talking multi-billion-dollar programs, very technically challenging, that unfold over a series of years, meaning a series of administrations and a series of Congresses. So in the case of something like an MV-22 for the Marine Corps, or the Expeditionary Fighting Vehicle, or the F-35 across three of the services, year after year after year, the service leadership goes before, has to debate within their own service, and then certainly with the within the Defense Department, and go before Congress and explain yet again why this particular program is so critical that it needs to continue to receive funding. And so you find that over time the service is building its reputation around, operational concepts around, and wrapping a lot of its institutional thinking and commitment around very key programs because of the requirement to sustain support over so many years. And I think this was certainly the case with the EFE, where commandant after commandant and administration after administration has said that the EFE is a gotta-have piece of gear. The MV-22 is a gotta-have piece of gear. And so the thinking of the institution, you know, throughout, especially such a great institution like the Marine Corps, where everybody falls in line and really does, you know, attend to what the commandant and the senior leadership are trying to push forward, the EFE is it. We've got to have 25 nautical miles. We've got to have rapid ship-to-shore maneuver. We've got to have compatibility with M1 tank, you know, speed and traffic ability. I mean, all these things kind of fall in step. And when you've been doing that for such a long time, it's hard to entertain seriously competing concepts. You know, do we need an EFE, or is something else as appropriate or capable? Does it have to be tracked, or can it be wheeled? I mean, are there other ways to think about it? And an inherent danger in that, from an institutional viewpoint, is if you come up with viable alternatives that perhaps are more affordable, you open up a window where Congress or somebody else can point to this viable alternative that's more affordable and select to fund that and pursue that, and you lose a program that you have been pushing for so many years. And so I think that brings an institution, Marine Corps, Army, Air Force, Navy, to a point where innovative thinking stagnates within that service, because you've been, again, trying to justify this key program in so many ways. And you just can't allow, you know, chink in that armor that you've built up around it, lest somebody try to make a raid on funding for it or redirect it in some other way, you know, when you've run into some kind of a problem. So that's what I was getting at. And I was trying to say that, you know, with an institutional commitment to these core programs for such a long period of time, and then the continued sustained focus on sustained operations ashore in Iraq and now in Afghanistan, it's difficult to shake loose from that stagnation and to think anew about operational concepts and material solutions that may be appropriate along these new lines of thinking.
When we're speaking about thinking along new lines, I mean, the commandant gave a speech recently to the Surface Navy Association, and he talks about the importance of having the Marine Corps as our crisis response team, and how crisis, I think the word, the actual quote is crisis response is incompatible with tiered readiness. And he also talks in, during that about the cancellation of the EFV and making the F-35B Bravo actually work, and address some other issues, including lightening the load that our Marines carry. Can you talk on those on that number of topics that I just raised?
Sure. I mean, the idea of tiered readiness is you've got some units that are in the fight. Obviously, you keep the most ready. The ones that are coming back kind of drop down in pecking order, and the one getting ready to go out is next in line to get new stuff, so it's ready to go. If you're going to have a crisis response force, it has to always be on the ready. And so I think he was trying to talk about the need to maintain funding and support for the service that could be viewed as the nation's response force. With regard to, what were the elements you just brought up there?
The cancellation of the EFB, the F-35
right.
Bravo, and the...
Yeah, you were saying that the EFE is just got to the point where it was going to be unaffordable. Some of the figures I've seen, or is it would account for something like 80% of all funding available for ground programs for the foreseeable future. And then the operations and maintenance cost was approaching something like $12,000 an hour for one of these vehicles. And so when a commandant, service chief, looks at all the things that he needs to have to make the service fully capable, it just seems unwise to invest such a huge percentage of that in a single platform, especially at the reduced numbers that they were looking at. And so he's trying to balance the capability set, and the secretary was assisting with that, that in canceling the program, it frees up that funding for reinvestment in other things. And the commandant, and as well as General Flynn there at McCitic and Quantico, were saying that they're going to be able to reapply that funding to extend the life of the AAV, to fund the Marine Personnel Carrier, the MPC, and look at some other material alternatives to a follow-on vehicle to the EFE. So that's one aspect, there. For the F-35B, he was very right to say that he's going to take personal interest in how the program is progressing. For your listeners, if they're not familiar, that was put on a probationary status. This is the STOVL, short takeoff vertical landing version of the Joint Strike Fighter that would be flown by the Marine Corps. It's had some challenges. The Secretary of Defense a couple weeks ago said that he would put that on probation for a two-year period of time. And if at that point it was still behind schedule and continued to be over budget, he would seriously consider canceling the program. I think of all the challenges facing the Marine Corps, to include the EFE, loss of the F-35B program is the one that should be most concerned about. With no other program that anybody's even talked about for replacing the AV-8B Harrier as a STOVL fixed-wing aircraft able to take off and land on the amphibious assault ships, loss of the F-35B would essentially leave the Marine Corps without a fixed-wing aviation capability capable of operating from short runways. So the STOVL capability gives you an ability to operate at C-130 length runways ashore, 3,000-foot runway or what have you. 10 times or more of those around the world than there are very long runways that a conventional fixed-wing aircraft would need. Loss of STOVL capability means that you're restricted for naval operations to just the 11 big deck carriers, whereas now you've got essentially 22 ships that you can operate from. And so if the Marine Corps loses that, what they only have in their hip pocket then is the F-18s or the F-35C that the Navy is continuing to pursue. So you would essentially lose fixed-wing marine aviation to operating off of Navy ships, carriers, or operating ashore as Navy and Air Force airplanes would do. And I think in terms of long-term capabilities and Marine Corps fixed-wing aviation, this is the challenge represented by the F-35 Bravo. So they have got to get that fixed because the implications of not doing so are pretty substantial further on down. And then the last point I think you made was about lightening the load. And that is also going to be very difficult. If you're concerned about the proliferation of guided weapons, anti-armor munitions, and the ease with which improvised explosive devices can be manufactured and placed. I mean, they're improvised by definition. And you think that that's going to continue to pose a significant threat to your land forces ashore. That is what's driven the Army and the Marine Corps and others to heavily armor their force. I mean, we had $20 billion or more committed to fielding MRAPs. We've had applique armor and additional bolt-on armor that have been sent out for strikers and AAVs and even main battle tanks, etc. All of our cargo vehicles are heavier than they were in the past. And so it's driven upward the weight of this force, how cumbersome it is, how much fuel it uses, the logistical and supply and maintenance support that goes along with that. And the Commandant realizes that this, too, is a threat to the nimbleness or the agility of Marine Corps forces as we have known them in the past. So we're now to a point where a Marine Corps unit embarks a Navy ship, whereas in the past the challenge was cubing out or using up the available cargo cube or space on a ship and its various storage decks and storerooms. Now weight is an issue. For the first time, we've got to a point where the weight put aboard a ship is proving to be a real impediment. And so for the Commandant to say we need to lighten the force, it kind of flies in the face of this more lethal environment ashore leading to more armor. And again, we go back to a point I made a bit earlier about expectations management. If lightening the force means reducing the armor component or the heaviness of the equipment that we're being embarked, you have to explain why it's critical to do so in order for the force that you're deploying to be effective in combat operations. At the very tactical level, we've seen analogous conditions where Marines have had to shed some of the encumbering body armor so that they could scramble up a hillside after the enemy. If you're carrying 60 pounds of weight, you just can't, one, avoid the enemy's fires or close with him rapidly enough to defeat him in combat. I think the same kind of condition exists at the major tactical and perhaps operational level when you think about the service as a whole and how it deploys for operations. So the Commandant, in trying to lighten the load, reduce the logistical footprint, and reduce the overall weight of this force, is going to have to accompany that with an explanation of why this is critical and why the Marine Corps needs to do it, and managing expectations and what potential casualties might be like in a given threat environment.
You know, Dakota, that leads perfectly into my next question, because it's not theory, it's within living memory fact. Whether you're talking about the use rate of ASW weapons by the British during the Falkland Island War, or you look at the shortage of 50 cal ammo right after the invasion of Afghanistan, where we were pulling out of the bunkers in Hawaii stuff of Korean War vintage and putting that up and making it run, especially with our reliance on precision guided weapons, and I call it the ignoring the unsexy, i.e. logistics. In spite of the fact that only two people really get a veto in operations, God and logistics, are we really appreciating the fact that even a medium level environment of consumption during any type of non-permissive environment where we don't have access to huge international runways, that logistics footprint when you first kick in the door, I think, is one argument. But there's also the tail that's going to be feeding everybody ashore really has withered on the vine in the last decade plus. How is that conversation going forward, and are the right people appreciating that, or are we just trying to wait it out and hope we don't need it?
No, I think it's recognized, and I think it's caused a lot of head scratching. It's just such a difficult problem to overcome that people are a bit stuck on what the solution might be. One solution is some kind of an alternative energy capability than bulk liquids. As long as you're burning fossil fuels and you have to move extraordinary amounts of diesel fuel of various types and various types of tankers, that's going to be a limiting factor. As long as you're shooting big heavy iron bullets of various types, just the sheer mass of that, difficult, the weight and getting it into theater, is going to prove to be a challenge. I mean, it just drives everything else. So lots of interest and resources are being poured into finding ways to lighten the fuel load. We're seeing your Marines using solar energy panels and the like in theater in Afghanistan and reducing fuel consumption just remarkably. And so perhaps that's one way to go about it. But this logistics footprint you've talked about is a real problem, and we have been so unnaturally blessed, I think, in the last couple of major wars. You know, if you think back to the Desert Storm 1990-91, when we had months to build up the Iron Mountains necessary to defend Saudi Arabia and then to push the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and then a repeat of that in 2003, where you had months and months to build up capabilities in Kuwait before the invasion of Iraq. And then the flow of logistics has been virtually unimpeded across hundreds and hundreds of miles going into Afghanistan. But we're seeing inklings where fuel convoys will be attacked sporadically, or there's some kind of a spat between Iran and Afghanistan, and fuel convoys will be halted, or the difficulties in diplomatic negotiations with Russia, you know, for passage to their country or what have you. And it does show you how tenuous operations can be when tied to these logistically intense tethers. And so, you know, people are recognizing that, but without an alternative to fossil fuels and these large, heavy munitions, you just, you know, go on a wing and a prayer that some kind of serious threat to your logistics and supply lines, you know, doesn't materialize that you have to direct resources, you know, to overcome. As far as precision munitions, you know, America loves those things. They minimize collateral damage. You can hit exactly what you want to hit. You can hit enemy forces in fairly close proximity to friendly forces with reduced fears of a blue-on-blue kill of some type. But these kinds of weapon systems are very, very expensive. They take a lot longer to manufacture and to replenish your stocks as you're using them at extended rates. So Undersecretary of the Navy Warrick has said, in pointing out how many vertical launch cells, for instance, aboard Navy ships we have compared to anybody else in the world, and all that is true. But once you've ripple-fired those VLS tubes, a ship has to go back to port to replenish those cells. You can't do underway replenishment of those kinds of capabilities. And so this continued reliance on guided weapons and precision systems, it is very, very difficult when you're playing an away game on extended line or exterior lines compared to the opponent who's operating on his home turf and is operating on interior lines. And so I think where we're getting to is a point where our correlation of forces analyses is going to change from a metric where you're counting his tanks and you're counting your tanks and seeing how you play it against that. Now you're going to have to see what is his inventory of guided weapons against what is your inventory of things that those guided weapons could be used against. So it would be platforms. So we may be getting into an era where I have to count anti-ship cruise missiles versus the number of ships that I have in the area, or his surface-to-air missiles against how many airplanes I have, or his anti-armor guided munitions against how many tanks or vehicles that I'm putting on the field. And if you go dollar for dollar, it's much less expensive to produce large inventories of guided munitions than it is to produce the key platforms that we're dependent on to do these kinds of expeditionary operations. And so when you look at industrial base funding and the types of vehicles and platforms we prefer to produce, it would seem to me at least that we're on the losing end of this kind of a cost-imposing approach to warfare. And that aspect I don't think has been thought through enough.
Well, speaking of things that may not have been thought through enough, let's talk about the MV-22 Osprey and where we should go as far as the lift capabilities that should be provided to the Marine Corps. The H-46 is older than I am, and that's pretty darn old, almost as old as older than I am. It's not quite that old. The H-53s are also really long in the tooth. And a quarter of a century into the MV-22 Osprey, what have we got? How are the Marines going to move logistics and stuff around using the helicopters and those aircraft they have.
Right. Well, I understand that the CH-53K program is pretty successful. All that I've heard on that is that that's a win story. And so we'll see the CH-53 Echoes replaced in fairly short order with the CH-53 Kilos. And so you'll have increased payload capacity and range and speed and all the things that come with a new airframe along those lines. So I think that's good news there. Where you're making trades, and I don't know that it's for the better, is replacing the CH-46 with the MB-22. It's in full production. It's performing very well, although you'll hear mixed views on readiness rates and what it takes to maintain those readiness rates and what the flight hour costs are. So I think there's some debate there. But it is no debate that you're spending somewhere around $100 million per aircraft, and you could probably buy three helicopters for the same amount. So where you're making investments is in range and speed with the MV-22. And what you're sacrificing is numbers of airplanes or aircraft that you're purchasing and perhaps lift capability, depending on the metric that you're using to measure a lift. Is it number of troops at a given range in a certain period of time, or is it sortie rates in a shorter distance? Do I need to move Marines from ship to shore rapidly within a certain distance? Or what is my external cargo carrying capability? An MV-22 flying at 200 knots is just not going to do it on all the same kinds of loads that a helicopter would be able to lift at a slower speed, but perhaps more weight. So there are so many ways to look at this problem that the entering arguments you're using to make these comparisons are critically important. And the folks that have been looking at it within the Marine Corps and within the naval systems that purchase aircraft for the Navy, for the Marines, and within DOD, hopefully are looking at this range of alternatives. You also have an increased footprint with MB-22 when you compare it to corresponding helicopters. So you're only able to embark, from what I understand, 10 MB-22s aboard an LHA, LHD, as opposed to a dozen or more helicopters that they're replacing. So when you then go back to the original argument about potential attrition or losses, each loss that you would take in an MV-22 force proportionally is going to be greater than similar losses with a helicopter-based force. And then the cost to replace those losses is going to be significantly more than 22 than with a helicopter. So if you look at the pattern here of investments, the Marine Corps appears to prize range, 1,200 nautical miles, straight-line distance range with a V-22, and just tremendous speed, prizing that more than numbers or perhaps other ways to think about lift that you would get with a helicopter. But the Marine Corps, again, from what they've been talking about, or the way they've been couching the program, is that the MV-22 is it. That's where they want to go. And so far, they've had the support from the Navy and OSD.
I think the speed fetish that a lot of people get focused on. You thought we would have learned that lesson with the battle cruisers and then the jet development in the late 50s and early 60s. It got hit in the forehead in Vietnam because speed isn't everything, because we saw the speed fetish really hurt us in LCS. And I agree with you, the 53K is a tremendous program. And I think all you need to do is talk to your standard issue Marine on the ground in Helmand Province and ask him about rotary wing, and he'll have good things to say for you.
In medevac, just as an example, if I'm a wounded Marine, what do I want getting me back to an appropriate level of medical care? If you can do that faster, that's a good thing. So there are lots of positive arguments for speed. In the offense, however, I've heard speed is just getting you to the ambush quicker. When you look at survivability of the platforms, again, the impact of a given loss, I think there is a bit of an over-argument made for speed, and you're seeing the same kind of criticisms in the LCS program. The littoral combat ship, fast. But what does fast really get you in a maritime environment, and at what cost? Dramatically increased fuel usage, to what end? And just going back to the point you were making about logistics, I don't know that we're placing enough importance on that component as an entire capability package, and we get overly enamored with one characteristic or aspect of a platform and just think that that's warrants the tremendous investment that's made in it.
It's a shame there can't be a little more discussions on the opportunity costs and trade-offs. Shifting a little bit back, one thing that I kind of had some fun with, if you saw a lot of the advertisements for the DDG 1000, it had this, you know, talk about stealth and this huge Graf Spee pocket battleship-sized ship offshore in this imaginary world where the hills are green and there's no house anywhere and nobody's shooting back at you. And I like to contrast that against the Israelis' foray, I think it's 18 months ago or so, into Gaza. There's some great, and it plays into your discussion about precision fires, there's some great video of their missile patrol boats closing the shore. And with precision-guided munitions, you can actually see them aiming and putting missiles through windows of condos, into garages and housing complexes, into specific businesses. Very close, very targeted, really taking on board, I think, the lessons that we saw in ground combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, where you want to be precise in an urban environment and the importance of that. And that's what I really think is the operational environment that more discussions need to be about, because if we ever have this huge Graf Spee-sized stealth ship that's going to close shore, it's not going to be verdant green hills. It's going to be a subdivision next to a housing complex, next to a refugee camp. Are we really focused on that different environment where you're not coming ashore in the Falklands or Normandy or some coral atoll in the middle of nowhere? You're coming ashore in somebody's subdivisions, like heck the Marines did in 58 in Lebanon. How is that discussion going, and are we getting the right tools in place to
think we are. I don't think the discussion is going appropriate to that at all, and we're not getting the right tools in place. I think it's along the lines of what you mentioned about becoming overly enamored with some kind of a sub capability set that, you know, with the DDG 1000, it has, what, you know, one gun on it now, and so you're having a continuing argument between the Marines and the Navy about naval surface fire support. You know, my one gun might be able to shoot, you know, 100 miles or so, but what's my rate of fire? And if I need volume instead of one bullet precisely, you know, placed, I don't know where the volume is coming from. It ranges instead of the bullet. I might have a vertical launch cell, but then we just talked about how quickly I deplete the number of cells I have aboard a given ship. So, you know, each one of these bullets, whether it's a vertical launch you know, missile out of a cell, or it's an extended range round fired from a deck gun, extraordinarily expensive. And it goes back to, you know, how much money do we have to sustain operations over time, especially in a high threat or an attrition intense environment. And we have had just the incredible luxury of taking $10,000 rounds and using them virtually with abandon. You know, no other country in the world thinks along those lines. And our people have been just tremendously supported by that, but it's also raised a level of expectation that operational concepts are dependent on this type of fire, and that, you know, casualties on either end are going to be, you know, what they have been. There's also an interesting kind of a counterintuitive problem that comes along with this, that where every platform I have takes on sniper-like capabilities, you know, aimed fire at extreme ranges and with great precision. When something goes wrong and you have the inevitable, you know, charge of that was a wedding party and not a gathering of warlords, or, you know, God forbid you should, you know, hit a schoolhouse, or you know, you have some kind of collateral damage in a neighborhood, you know, that you just talked about. The critique could be that was intentional, because we have the ability to precisely target whatever we want. It implies whatever we have hit, that's what we intended to hit. And so, you know, that component as well, I mean, it shouldn't drive our thinking, but we should be certainly be informed by that. And it just seems we're spending a lot of money that is less and less available with the bow wave expenses hitting the nation here in the next decade or so, into capability sets that are fewer in number and that are extraordinarily expensive, you know, to employ, and I don't know that the return in an operational and tactical sense is quite what we're expecting that it's going to be.
Well, one of the questions, I guess, and if you're talking about saving valuable dollars, is that assuming that, the environment in which we're operating is safe for a DDG 1000 or some of these other vessels, is there any value to a concept like the old monitor ships of World War II, large, slow vessels, but with a heck of a lot of guns that could be used to, with modern weapon systems, be used to provide the Navy gunfire support sort of thing that would be required in the modern world? Any possibility of something like that, something slow and stupid, but cheap?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think numbers matter, and I think we just haven't invested in experimentation, or as Dr. Andrew Krepinevich has termed in years past, wildcatting, where I invest a little bit in a number of different capability sets, and I experiment with those things, and I find out, you know, what mix works. It seems that we do a lot of background analysis, and then we commit to a single major program, and we just bet the farm that that particular program is going to work. You know, we're seeing that in various kinds of neckdown strategies, where I go from multiple types of platforms down to a single platform that's supposed to do everything for everybody. Heaven help us if that particular approach or that single platform develops some kind of a material defect that wasn't anticipated, and you find your entire fleet has been grounded, you know, for some period of time. So a low and slow approach, it's heavily gunned up, you know, almost a Soviet style, right, where all their platforms just bristled with armament, may be appropriate. It gives me a tremendous amount of firepower, very heavily armored. You know, one way to deal with a high-threat environment is just by sheer mass, and I can take a lot of hits and still keep swinging myself, as opposed to light and nimble, which is an approach that we have preferred to take, where I'm fast, I have great operational awareness of where the threat is, and I can avoid that threat. You know, you're a lightweight fighter versus a very heavy, ponderous fighter. But we just haven't done the experimentation, I think, to really say one way or the other what might be a profitable approach. And so I'd say if we have any failure or vulnerability in our way of thinking, it's this lack of you know, really good, solid experimentation.
Back in 08, when the heavy brain work started to get done for the latest surge we saw in Afghanistan, and as the Army and the Marine Corps decide, you know, who's going to get what territory where, you know, part of the driving discussion of that, of why the Marines wind up going where they were going, is the Marines and their skill sets and their tactical habits really played itself well towards the terrain and Regional Command South, where dismounted operations were almost required in some of those areas and valleys, while the Army's more mechanized was more appropriate towards the east of the country. And you know, you talked a bit about the fact that in many ways the Marine Corps has spent the last year as a second land army, almost like they did in the First World War, but they still retain some of their skills and habits that really aren't in place in any number in the Army. When you look at our experiences, what are those things that you think the Marines have learned in the last decade that they need to hoist on board and keep, refine, and make better? But what are some of those habits, either by osmosis or design, that they've picked up in the last decade the Marines need to get rid of and forget as we look forward in maintaining what is a unique capability for this nation?
I think what they need to retain is really wouldn't come as a surprise to the Marines at all, and that's a validation of investing in developing, growing Marines. The basic training that Marines start with, you know, 13 weeks followed by 3 weeks of Marine combat training. You know, you've got 4 months invested in a young Marine before he ever hits the operating forces. And so this focus on the individual Marine and making sure that he's a well-schooled marksman, that he's heavily trained and educated in the tactical skill set, the various training regimens and exercises they go through in preparation for deployment overseas, make just fantastic small unit leaders. And so I think, again, this validation to the approach of making Marines and really building up the Marine Corps' ethos and its cultural heritage and all the things that go into a Marine have just been borne out time and time again at the small unit level. And these guys have just proven themselves, guys and gals have proven themselves time and time again, both in Anbar province and then now in Helmand and other places in Afghanistan. So that's going to reinforce within the Corps. We're doing good things, and we need to keep doing good things in our training and education programs. I think a lesson that probably has been learned of something to step away from, the Commandant has already mentioned that, and that's to be wary of getting too heavy, whether it's taking on MRAPs or saddling some guy with 60 or 70 pounds of protective equipment. Sometimes lighter can be more lethal because it gives you the freedom and the agility, the maneuverability to adjust to the enemy's disposition and to counter him and go into the attack, you know, whenever that's needed. So this desire to lighten the force we just talked about earlier, to be light and lethal, to be expeditionary in mindset where I can go anywhere at any time because I have the ability to do that, and I'm not constrained by the absolute requirement for heavy lift everywhere I go, the Marine Corps does need to shed some weight. But, you know, as I said earlier, along with that is going to come expectations management and a very vigorous not just a public relations campaign, but a very clear explanation to OSD and to members of Congress and the political establishment about what the Corps is able to do if it is freed to be able to do that, but what the consequences might be in accomplishing the objectives set before it.
Well, let me kind of go light on you, and I know that the U.S. Navy at one point was looking at the, are you familiar with this Super Tucano, the Embraer aircraft that can be used for special operations? Right. Would the Marines be interested in something like that if it could be fixed up to work off some of these large amphib flight techs?
I haven't heard any discussion about that. I mean, you know, the Air Force looked at something like that for, an IW wing, an irregular warfare wing. An aircraft better suited to the types of operations you're talking about, a bit more understandable to other countries that the U.S. Operates with. I mean, it's hard to show up in a third world country or with a partner or an ally you're trying to develop in a region with your fifth-gen fighter, and they're still using something that was produced back in the 1970s. Sometimes speed is not good and is counterproductive, and I need something slow like an A-10 Warthog, with a big gun on it that is able to, you know, fly over a battlefield, find tanks, and kill them. So there is great utility to that. There is a reluctance on the part of the services to pursue those paths because it would compete for funding with these other major programs, you know, whether it's F-35 and its various iterations, what have you. And so there's a reluctance to generate this new capability that really isn't out there. I haven't heard any discussion within the Marine Corps about pursuing something like that that would be adaptable to flight operations on an amphib. It's an interesting concept, but they haven't had a prop-driven aircraft for years and years. So that would be something new, and maybe it warrants some discussion and a little bit of experimentation, but there's nothing on the books that I'm aware of.
Just kind of continuing on the theme of little platforms, so to speak, when you look back towards the end of the Vietnam conflict in ground combat, one thing that really became an issue was the RPG-7. And we saw towards the end of Vietnam that the 113s were having the cages put on them. Slide armor became used on a regular basis. But then that was kind of forgotten in the interim. And then you saw again, the hillbilly improvised chain link fence armor around some of our vehicles until we got the production back, and we relearned that lesson. And then for the last 10 years during what I still call the Long War, something that the South Africans during the apartheid era learned, and the Israelis as well, was the IED. We had to learn that hard lesson ourselves again. So what do you see what the RPG-7 was to Vietnam and the IED was afterwards, what do you see as the next thing that at the tactical level in ground combat is going to be something that we're going to see in the future be a great threat? Not that the great strategists and the operational types are worrying about, but the strategic corporal needs to worry about to keep his Marines and soldiers safe because the other guy is using it.
I think it's this proliferation of precision in all its forms, you know, guided weapons, et cetera, you know, whereas you know, the RPG-7, I mean, it just, you know, changed the landscape in terms of that, you know, how it was employed in a variety of tactical circumstances. You know, now we've got the RPG-29 out there. It's been in production for, you know, a decade or two, but it's making more and more of an appearance, and it gives you something like 1,000 meters range warhead that can penetrate the armor of a main battle tank, just extraordinarily effective. And so we're just seeing this migration to more sniper-like capabilities and the advance of modern technology where the warheads are ever more capable of helping to find a target, which reduces perhaps some of the training and education requirements on the part of the shooter. The warhead with its seeker being able to find the target that you're shooting at, and the warhead itself being ever more capable in the chemistry of that explosive to have an effect on impact. So the more we see of this across the battlefield, the more worry you're going to have among small unit commanders of the enemy I'm closing with is still out of visual sight range in the simplest sense, especially in complex and cluttered terrain like broken terrain and urban environments, and yet the weapons that they will increasingly have can reach out hundreds of meters, if not more, with great precision. So any vehicle I bring to the field is going to have a big target painted on the side of it. So I think we're going back to an era of small unit tactics, of light infantry that are enabled with modern weapons and communications and the ability to coordinate operations in more of a distributed nature. Where protection is going to come from dispersion, and lethality is going to come from an ability to better coordinate fires that you can bring to bear against the enemy. If you jump into almost a sci-fi realm and somebody figures out how to fix the directed energy problem, where I have a substantial energy source that I can convert into some kind of a directed stream, I mean, that'll be the next big ticket. But even with all the resources we're bringing to bear against it, it's still a tough challenge to overcome. You know, how do I focus a laser of a given type for a certain period of time to impart enough energy to disrupt, you know, whatever the target is I'm aiming at? But decades down the road, I think that's where things are going. In the next decade or two, it's going to be the proliferation of these standoff weapons that have better guidance systems, seeker warheads, and are able to have impact on whatever target they hit. Anytime we sit down, we build up command and control centers, logistics bases, supply depots, medical capabilities. Any one of these sitting fixed targets is going to be vulnerable to guided mortar rounds or flat trajectory anti-armor types of rounds that can be brought to bear against them. The Israelis found great effect in using direct fire weapons, thermal barracks, etc., that we had a sniper among Hezbollah in a building. Instead of trying to discreetly find the window, you just brought the building down. So, you know, these kinds of tactics, I think, our guys are going to come up against more and more, and the ranges are just going to increase, and how that's going to complicate closing with the enemy and trying to engage that enemy without undue harm to non-combatants in the area will be a significant problem.
Well, Dakota, we've got about a minute left. If some of our listeners are interested on getting hold of more of your thoughts and some of the works you've done recently, where can they find them?
Well, CSBA has a website, CSBA, Charlie Sierra Bravo Alpha Online, online.org. And just about everything we do for public consumption is posted on there. And then just an email, happy to entertain any kind of queries at dwood, D-W-O-O-D, at csbaonline.org. And, you know, maybe send something through you and you can forward it along as well. Happy to help out.
Be happy to. Well, Dakota, thank you very much for giving us an hour of your day here this Sunday. Appreciate you coming on. I look forward to the next opportunity to talk to you.
Sure. Looking forward to it as well. Take care.
Thank you, Dakota. Good night.
And thanks to everybody who joined us today, and we're up in the chat room. I appreciate it. Go forward and have a great Navy Day.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the strand and